think Mike, if y'all don't have any more readings, I'm probably going to sit down for a little bit longer. I got to stop at 8 o'clock, right? I'm not sure if it's going to be like that. I am Sage. I'm an alcoholic. My physical sobriety date is January 18th, 1998, and my sobriety date now is February 22nd or 24th, 1998. And I changed that, I didn't have any problem having that changed. That's when I actually was out of the wing from treatment center, et cetera, and I begun AA. That's pretty much the reason for that, but there's a big difference between just not drinking and going to AA and just sitting in the meeting. There's more to it than that, and I found that out after about 6 months of just not drinking. But as Mike said, my home group is the Buckingham Big Book Group, and it meets Tuesday night in Buckingham, Maysville Baptist Church, and that's where you'll find me every Tuesday night. I have commitments in AA. I have jobs in AA. Those are my commitments, and all that's good stuff that I had no idea that was going to be really helpful later on. I always thought it was tricks, you know, how the sponsors tricked me into all this stuff. But you know, a fellow before the meeting mentioned, Bill mentioned before the meeting, he said, you know, he noticed I was here last week and I came up just to, you know, to be in an AA meeting, and he mentioned consistency, and you know, that's been a key for me, and how I got to be consistent here is pretty much through structure, through sponsorship, and the things that I've learned from the people that came before me. It's interesting. I'm not going to really read in here, but I saw the cornerstone on this building out here, and this happened to be 1998. And so I remember something in the book here that reminded me of it. And I guess it's talking about step two. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? That's just a simple question that may have been put to me in a little bit simpler terms outside in the parking lot after a meeting. And it goes on to say that it has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. And I didn't know that these principles, ideas, actions that my sponsor was going to have me take was actually going to begin that. So that's just an interesting tidbit. You know, I've heard a lot of things shared at the beginning from a podium, and I don't know if I have those feelings, but I'm going to read four sentences here, and then I'm going to put this book away, and I'll see if I can say a little bit more about me. One of the reasons I'm here is, this is in Dr. Bob's Nightmare 181. Sense of duty, it is a pleasure, because in so doing so, I'm paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip, so... And the preamble is another reason I'm here. You know, I have a primary purpose today, and that's to stay sober and help others to achieve sobriety. That's pretty much, you know, all I need to do here. Anyway, I came to you, like I said, in about 1998. I had much longer hair. I had a beard, mustache. Had a knife on my side, had a pair of hunting boots on, a blue jeans, an uncollared shirt, and a hat for every meeting, and that's how I came here. And, you know, I got here by the way of a treatment center, and I didn't really know it was called a treatment center. Chart of Behavioral System, and, you know, it kind of rang a bell with me at first, you know, like, yeah, that's what I need. And probably not drinking, you know, maybe not, or maybe, you know, I really don't know. What I do remember is I didn't like the way my life was going, and I was tired of it. And it wasn't for a while that I really knew, had been in AA for a while, that, you know, I think I really did have a desire to stop drinking. I'm not sure it was an honest desire. I didn't really know exactly the severity of alcoholism. And as time went on, you know, I could see where, you know, I was really trying to do a lot of controlling in my drinking, you know, even from the start. There are many different ways that I did that, and without success. You know, there were times where circumstances would stop me from drinking, and that would be the Westmoreland County Sheriff's Office and Virginia State Police and Virginia Game Commission, and you know, maybe my, some of the things I did in private school, and maybe some suggestions from my dad that gave me the impression that, that my mother wasn't taking it too well, and you know, I didn't really see it that way. But anyway, that's how I one of the ways that I ended up here is my life wasn't going well, and you know, I've heard a lot of folks talk about, you know, can't imagine living, keep on drinking or and living without drinking. I had the idea when I first got to that treatment center was, as I hung around AA a little bit, I started to hear some things that, that kind of concerned me. It's like, you mean I'm just not going to be able to drink again? And I can't imagine. You know, I couldn't imagine living without maybe taking a drink at some point down the road. And that's nothing more than an alcoholic, you know, just, you know, wanting to live that lie out again. You know, I know the truth about my drinking today, and that came about by going to some AA meetings and listening. I didn't get a whole lot from the treatment center, but because I thought I knew it all anyway. You know, I got an A in my drug education class in high school. I think I missed one, and I really remember this too. And I mean, I knew what acid and mushrooms, you know, mescaline. I knew all the stuff: sobers, downers, reds, all that stuff. You know, some of that stuff I didn't like, but and, you know, the one I got wrong was an alcohol and a depressant. And I'll be daggone if it ever depressed me. That's the truth. And so there were a lot of ideas I had when I got here that, you know, they won't work for a guy like me. When I was in that treatment center, they suggested I get a sponsor and go to AA meetings, and I think they probably said, you know, two or three or whatever. And, you know, so I did about 50% of that, and I got nothing from it. I believe that, you know, I did come to believe that there was a power after just not drinking for 6 months and, you know, getting a little bit of knowledge about things that really don't treat my alcoholism. But that was fine. And I remember being in a meeting, and I had probably gotten down to, I know, one Saturday meeting. And maybe one other one during the week. That's what I was down to after 6 months. And, you know, the person who was living with me at the time, well, I found out after one of those nights when they group us up that they were going to have a topic in there about a dry drunk. And I found out that came from my house. They needed to talk about a dry drunk. And what that really was is just untreated alcoholism. That's the way, I mean, when I'm untreated here, and that was pretty much, I almost look at it as, you know, during the day, you know, I strived on not drinking till after 4 o'clock. That wasn't always the case, but, and stay away from the, before noon drink. So early on, I knew there was something about, trying not to get into those habits and so, you know, maybe I'm trying to control my drinking already, but I started out a blackout drinker from the start. Then I spent the next 29 years trying to figure out how to not black out. And I guess there were some less frequent blackouts, but there were certain ways that I tried to eliminate, and that's, you know, the things, you know, that I do before I drink or after I drink or what I drink. And, you know, I started out drinking hard liquor and ended up drinking beer plus hard liquor. It took me about 20 years to hold down everything overnight, and then the last years of my drinking, there wasn't anything to come up, so that was much better. But I suffered a great deal with hangovers. I don't know how. I don't know my willpower when it comes to that. Has been able to survive a hangover and do it all over again amazes me. That's one of the reasons that I could not do it is because I'm an alcoholic. I never had the power whether I decided whether I was going to drink or not. It was going to happen sooner or later. Before I really get started, there are some things that I learned here early on. And that was through sponsorship. And, I go to no less than 4 meetings a week. And the average is probably 5. And I've done that ever since I've been here. So Bill is right. Consistency is, at least it's been really good for me. And there are a few things that I learned early in AA, not specifically out of the book. One of them was to look like a sober member of AA. And so I got rid of the boots and the knives and the hats and the beard. And learned how to sit still in an AA meeting for an hour. And do all the things that's announced at a lot of meetings. And I didn't have a problem doing that. And, because I had lost my defiance here. I was willing to take direction from somebody else, and this is what I was getting. I learned to act better than I feel. I learned that really early on. I'm not always going to feel good, but I can certainly act better. And another big one, we were talking before the meeting, somebody asked me if my sponsor had ever left me. I said, yeah, he left me once. And, I learned something that time. I'll tell you just a little bit about that. I was supposed to meet him at his house, and we're going to ride to the meeting, which we frequently do. And, He set a time to be there, and so I got there like 3 or 4 minutes past that time. He was gone, and this guy's that's terrible to leave a guy like that. And we're about 10 miles from the meeting. I said, if I go fast enough, I believe I could catch him. If he went the other way, I might get there before he does. And I remember doing it, and I got there, and he was already there, and I sat down. I said, where were you? I said, I said, 7 o'clock, be there at 7 o'clock. And he said, you weren't there. And I went, okay. And, I didn't like that at first, for the first few minutes. And I went, he's right. And that's where I started to learn a little bit about my behavior. That's inconsiderate if I'm late. So that's one of the most important things I've learned here is to be on time. And I believe that's a spiritual action. I've noticed that more often, in the last 6 months. And one quick way to relate that is if I'm going somewhere and I'm late and I watch what I do or I pay attention to it, it's not spiritual. And so that's an easy illustration for me that that being on time is very spiritual. The logging truck doesn't seem to be going very slow. The old lady in front of me doesn't seem to be going slow. The red light, I don't care how long it takes, because I'm on time. And so right now is important. So that's a lot of the stuff I learned early on that became very helpful. And, before I actually started drinking, along in grade school, it just seemed like I just wasn't comfortable around other people. I wasn't, I wasn't as tall as everybody, obviously, and that seemed like that was a weakness that I had, and there were a lot of things I did to overcome that. I didn't know a lot of this till later on, but I would be the class clown, or I could be the teacher's pet, or that sort of thing. I did a lot of things to compensate on my how inferior I felt. I was shy. Early in my life, I do remember that. There was something later on that would take care of that. And You know, I found out a few years ago that the shyness is nothing but self-centeredness, self-centered fear. That's all it is. And so that was good to know. I remember it was around in the seventh grade. Matter of fact, in the seventh grade, there was a recess, and then we left for, got on the bus and all that. We had to go back into school, but there were three or four of my friends, and, you know, they're all right now, they're all about 6'4", and so when I was in sixth and seventh grade, we all hung out together, and so, you know, I always wanted to feel like those guys, and they seemed to do well at sports. You know, I did play sports, but they seemed like they had a distinct advantage on me. And one of them brought something from home. It was in a Listerine bottle. Probably the bottle was about like this. And four of us drank that, and I'd say that's my first significant amount that I had. And I remember it was the same feeling I got when I drank hard liquor with nothing in me yet. It was, you know, a pretty warm feeling going down, and a nice warm feeling. And I didn't say I was going to do that right away, or I was going to set out and do that again. I had some, you know, before that I had quite a few sips of beer, you know, from my uncles and aunts that were over, and I did notice that they all had a jolly time when they were drinking, and so I had, there was some mystique about drinking. I used to stay at my friend's house a lot in those years, and we'd watch all the John Wayne and all those movies where they were rattling, you know, Rockford Fire, and all those movies where they're rattling that ice around, or they're not using ice at all, and you know, Clint Eastwood and all, and it seemed like they all had a toughness about them too, and so I had some intrigue about alcohol. And there are some other reasons, but, you know, I know if I'm not supposed to do it, it'd be a good idea to try it. And so that's pretty much what I did, and I thought it was cool. And, you know, later on, I was just keeping up with the Joneses. I was just following, you know, what everybody else does. And then years later, I found out that everybody doesn't do that. And so I was in the seventh grade, and then I, you know, moved on to high school, and I started getting in a little bit of trouble, not from drinking, but just kind of clowning around, you know, breaking rules, you know, smoking in the bathroom, you know, providing a cigarette for the M80, that kind of thing. And we did, you know, I did a lot of that. And during that time, it was like the weekends, I didn't have a driver's license, but there was always somebody that could get us around, and usually it was at a football game, so we go to the football game, then the basketball game, and I didn't drink at the basketball games. I don't understand that. Maybe they wouldn't let you in and out. And I remember I had my little clarinet piece, the mouthpiece, and I'd be in the top blowing that thing every time. You know, that's the way I was. I was just a clown. And you know, I thought it was cool. But anyway, I moved on through high school, and actually I went to 2 years in public high school, and then my folks sent me to a college preparatory school, and as all my brothers and sisters went, it seemed like everybody in the neighborhood. And, you know, it wasn't for years later that I found out the reason they sent me for there was to get a background for a college education, and that's not the way I took it at the time. I remember exploding one night after being confronted about something after I'd been out of school, and I said, "It's all your fault. You hadn't sent me to that school. It's all your fault." I remember saying that, and I stormed out of the house in my suitcase. And I think I came back the next day. I just didn't quite have everything arranged. But anyway, that's some of my behavior. You know, I'd isolate. I'd get quiet. I'd pout. I did a lot of that stuff as a young kid when I didn't get my way. And then I went to, this is before I went to private school. I think it was in the ninth. As soon as I got my driver's license, I guess that's 17, 18 or somewhere in there. And I started to get into a little bit of trouble. And my memory's not as good as some folks in here that I don't understand how people's memory's so good. But anyway, my first encounter was, you know, I was hanging out with a friend of mine who, was older than I was, and I remember when he came back from Vietnam, and this is before I really started drinking, and we'd all go peek in the bar window and see this fella. Guy's from Vietnam. He's tough. And he'd have one of those orange cafeteria trays there full of screwdrivers. And that's how he drank when he got back, and refused to drink cold beer. When I got a little bit older, he drank cold beer. And, you know, I ask about him from time to time. You know, he doesn't drink like that anymore. It's kind of weird, but anyway. So I was hanging around this guy, you know, being cool, and I liked the guy. We had some things in common, and we went out one night, and, you know, probably had the proper amount of beer, you know, six between the two of us, and, you know, he had a pint under the floorboard, so we drank everything we had, and then, you know, we smoked some stuff, and we got into that pint, and, of course, I'm going to show this fella how I can drink. You know, I'm about 17 now, and, you know, I drank too much of it, and, came time for him to drop me off, and I dropped me off at my mother's car, and I didn't know this, but I fell on the ground when I got out, and somebody told me about it later, and that I'd fallen down, and he asked me if I could drive okay, and of course I could, but so I got in the truck, and I was parked across from high school, went the wrong way, and started heading the other way, why I don't know, I was in a blackout, and I went about a mile and a half on the straightaway, rear-ended the car, and buckled it up to the back seat. There were two kids in there, and whoever was driving didn't hurt anybody. You know, this is a small town where everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everything. Everybody knows what kind of trash can you got out back and, you know, how often you empty it, you know, all that kind of stuff, what you're driving and all that stuff, you know, who your folks are. And being a small town, I tell you, I was crushed by that because everybody knew about it. Worst of all, my dad was an attorney in this town, and that didn't go over too well between him and I. And so I got my first DUI, and I didn't have much respect for the police officers, especially in a blackout. But, you know, I got out, you know, they started to do things a little different later on. They cuffed me and put the seatbelt on. And, you know, this time, you know, I knew the state police. We had a nickname for him, Babyface Riley, yeah. And so I got out of the car. I grabbed his hat, got out of the car, and started directing traffic. Now, I remember a little bit of that. And then he got me back in the car, and it was a 20-mile drive to the hospital for a blood test. And I used all the stuff that I picked up in grade school, you know, what to say to somebody like that. And I did that for 20 minutes. And I got there, and I was in and out. I remember it was like looking in an old tunnel. It was all dark around me. I could see a little bit. I was in and out. And so anyway, and I finally get to court, you know, and this was a tough time for me to get in front of that judge. My dad's standing there, and everybody knows everybody in there. I know it humiliated him, but he didn't let on to that, but I know it did. It certainly made me, you know, feel that way. They joked about it a little bit. Him and the judge, you know, Mr. Robertson, you waived the right, whatever, you know. You know, they were chuckling up there, and I was just scared to death. You know, he's going to throw the book at me, and, you know, this is the end of it here. And, you know, I got what was coming to him. My dad, you know, he didn't try to work any angles or go in the back room or anything like that. He wasn't like that. He was a principled man. And so he said I was embalmed. That's what he told me. Blood count was 0.32. And I was just about out of it. I was just about gone. But anyway, that was my first brush with trouble. And that wasn't going to be the first in my hometown. And then, you know, I really guess I was glad I moved away from that town. I don't know the years on this. I'm just going to spill out a couple more. But just to let you know how I was, you know, how I felt, you know, we had this little coffee house in that small town. It's right in the downtown. It's a real small town. And I was never comfortable going in there, but my best friend and I would get a pint of Bourbon Supreme and a 12-ounce Coke, and that was perfect. Every time, it was perfect. And then, you know, here we go again. I'm trying to show these older guys how tough I am. And an upperclassman was in there, and he said, what you been drinking, Sage? I said, well, me and Herbie have some Bourbon Supreme, but, you know, I got something good at home if you want to try that. So I went, took him to my house. My parents were home. I told them I was going to take Franz down here and show him the workshop, which is a small little shop. We were building a little radio or something down there. Anyway, I told him a lie. I got him downstairs, and I siphoned off some more of that moonshine. It was in a charcoal keg that I helped my dad put in there. And it really hadn't got that dark look to it yet, but later on it did. And we siphoned off some of that. And he drank just a little bit of it, but, you know, I got to show this guy, too. So I drank a good part of it. I don't know how much more it was. And then to shorten it up a little bit, I woke up underneath the water tower right behind this place. An hour or so later, my father's partner was nudging me, and he got me up from being passed out, and walked me across the street, put me in my mother's car, and I went home. And then my parents made me get up and go to basketball practice at 9 o'clock in the morning. And that was one of the toughest ones I ever went through, because the whole town knew about Sage passing out underneath the water tower. And But none of that stuff really stopped me. It may have curtailed it for a little while. I went on to private school, to Dry County, dry school, and not allowed there. And, one night during the week, somebody'd make a beer run, and I got caught. Actually, I didn't do the running. I just did the bringing in. And I had a couple cases on the bed, and it was being distributed, and one of the residents came in when the door was open, and I threw the towel over at one side and got caught with 5 beers, and got suspended. And my dad had to come up there again and pick me up, and I had to go through all that again. So here I am, keep humiliating this father of mine, and as well as my mother. And then later on, that when I was in that school, coming back on a Sunday night, I did have a mother's car that time, and I guess I was probably a senior if you're allowed to do that. And so we ended up down this subdivision, playing around and out of beer, and started kicking a few doors down and practicing some martial arts. There were 2 or 3 of us, and we finally found some beer in those cottages, and we had what I wanted. And a day or two later, the dean of students called me and said, "Your father's in the. You need to go see the dean of students." And I went in there, and there's my father. He's got a briefcase with him this time, and got in trouble for that. And it's funny how some of these folks out here, they know about restitution, and they're not even in AA. That's what we had to do. And we returned the fans. You know, I had one in my window that blew that other smoke out. And cushions and stuff I didn't even need. And so we had to return that and pay for the damages. And so that's just the stuff that that's just what happened when I drank. And it's not that I wanted to stop drinking. I just was trying to figure out how not to get into trouble. So so I started getting a little bit better at it. But I had another DUI. And I've been stopped again. I think I've wiggled out twice. The only time I've wrecked 3 vehicles, and I was in a blackout all 3 times. I didn't realize that for years, being in AA, that I was actually in a blackout. And I got lucky with those. My wife at the time knew the state trooper. He was real young, and I blew up that balloon, even though my lip was busted. He beat that balloon on that steering wheel, I know, for 20 minutes. And Sage, by that time, my wife had brought my truck down there. I wrecked her MG. And somebody cleaned the car up a little bit so the cops wouldn't find the other stuff in there. But anyway, he said, "I want you to go back in your truck. I don't want to see you again tonight." So evidently, I was smart with him, but I don't remember that. Because I knew a little bit of stuff then. Like, don't get smart with him. You got a chance with this guy. And so I went to court, and he wrote me a ticket for improper driving. And I got to court, I still remember it. Improper driving, $15 fine. And years later, I went, "I wish he'd give me that ticket." And me saying that was that wouldn't have done any good. I know that today. That kind of stuff didn't stop me from drinking. I never could have a long-term relationship with the opposite sex. I've been married twice, and I tell this not to be really funny, but it is funny, but it's the truth. The reception lasted longer than the marriage. That's the way it was. I remember, actually, one was up here in Orange, and 3 days before, I got 2 kegs of my favorite beer and iced them down, and I kept them on ice for 3 days, and stayed there the next day to finish him up with whoever was left. And boy, things have changed. But anyway, I always, you know, even when I was living in that small town, I moved. It took me a while to figure this one out, but I'd moved 13 times. I really hadn't gone anywhere. And, you know, the way I ended up in Buckingham County was I was in another one of those relationships that it wasn't going to work. And I guess I just, you know, I said, well, I'll find a place out here and, you know, I'll start over again, that kind of thing. I've heard that a lot here. And, but you know, when I moved here, I started all over again. I don't think I ever stopped. It just seems like it's a good idea, you know, to do stuff like that. But anyway, there are some things happened before I moved that I didn't realize. You know, a lot of this stuff didn't come to me after I'd been sober a while. I didn't realize that non-alcoholics count the nights you've been out drinking. And just to show you a little bit how I am, I was probably early in AA, and my girlfriend at the time, who lived with me, well, is in the process of moving out. Somebody asked me what happened to my, what happened to my face, and I was gonna kind of grandstand it a little bit, and. Started to make a joke about contact darts, and I got cut right off, and she said, that was your 13th night at it in a row. And, you know, I didn't know that. And, of course, I never really, you know, did that anymore, but I'd forgotten about that. This was at the end of my drinking. I moved here and then got sober 3 months later, but, yeah, I was talking about earlier about these things that I used to do to compensate. And what that really is me trying to show everybody else that I'm okay. And so I had a lot of hobbies, and I excelled at most of them. And it was sometime in AA before I realized that, you know, some of those things were going away. And, you know, I remember playing golf at 16, 14, and 15 before I really got drinking. Because my parents would let me go down to the real itsy bitsy country club. Now it wasn't fancy, you know. It wasn't fancy, and the golf course was wide open, so it was easier. But you know, I was playing golf with guys 20 years older than I was, and I could hang in there with them. And then I remember years later when I was drinking, you know, I used to say to myself, they only knew what was going on. It's no wonder that, you know, I've got a reason why I can't hit it straight anymore. But what that really was, I'm so distracted and so uncomfortable, I just can't play golf anymore. I didn't like to play golf drinking because I can't. And that's probably why, you know, I'm just not comfortable. In later years, I took up tennis, and right in college, and it wasn't at college, but, and then I remember I was mad at the high school for tearing up the tennis court and putting a new building there, because I could have been a tennis professional. You know, that's kind of, you know, way my mind goes. Always blamed everybody else for everything. And so I started playing competitively after I got started. I picked it up quick, and I went to a lot of tennis tournaments, you know, seen a lot of the good pros, and just awesome to watch these guys. And, you know, I wasn't drinking when I was watching them, and I wasn't drinking when I was playing. I did quite a bit of drinking afterwards. See, that's compensating there. And so I played in a tri-county region. I played in tournaments and did well, played doubles, mixed doubles and singles. And there were a few guys that could beat me on a given day and vice versa. I certainly wasn't the best, but I was right at the top. And that's where my drinking was getting really out of hand. Didn't realize it. And, you know, I remember going and getting a lesson. You know, I'd rent a ball machine and just pound the ball for hours. And anyway, I decided I'm going to get a lesson. You know, it's time to move on up. And I went and got a lesson. I think I was out of state at the time. And I got this lesson. And it was in Fredericksburg, indoors. And I went and got a lesson from this pro. And I said, well, he said, you must be the terror of the town court. And he said, all you need to do is work on your strategy. And so, you know, I thought about that years later. You know, I started to not really have that drive for it anymore because, you know, I thought I'd been there and done that one in. But what really was happening was I was doing a lot of drinking. I remember being at bars saying, I've got to go home. I got a tournament tomorrow, and I could do that starting out. This is a three-year period. I could do that. I could get back home and get some good rest. And you know, if I did have to play, I'd start drinking late in the afternoon and try to get home and pass out early and have plenty of rest. But anyway, it got to the point where I'd be playing hungover. And then when I won, you know, I'd say to myself, if those people only knew what I did last night. I used to say that about my partner I worked with. When I go by at night at the bar, I see his bedroom light go out. And I'd get up in the morning, I'd work him all day long. I'd work all day. And I'd anticipate that drink every day that's going to happen after I get off of work. I compensated by working not drunk. I never worked a lick drinking, never did. That's not the way I was. Some people did. I just wasn't like that. So anyway, that's a lot of the stuff that happened in those years. So I finally moved to Buckingham. There were quite a few other things that happened. You know, I was constantly disappointing my parents. My dad had an open invitation of everyone to go to school. He'd always pay for it. He always had. I just couldn't stay at it. And never could figure out what I wanted to do, never have. Pretty much. I'm happy right where I am today, wherever that is, because of AA. But, you know, I ended up moving to Buckingham in a failing relationship, actually. And I was scared to drive to Charlottesville to drink, because I still was a bar drinker, but there were times where that did get old, and the chance of getting in trouble was more, so I'd do the old farmhouse porch nighttime drinking with one of my buddies. And so I stayed away from a lot of trouble. When I got to AA, I hadn't had a DUI in 23 years. And I think I'm not going to sit here and think that I had anything under control. I just didn't get caught, but I did less of it. So when I was in Buckingham, I lived in a very rural area, still do, and afraid to drive to Charlottesville. I liked this house. It had a little college refrigerator in it. And I don't think I ever wanted to hide my beer drinking from anybody else, but for some reason I guess I was, because I usually kept a whole lot in there and fewer in the one in the kitchen. And maybe that's because if one of my other drinking buddies, you know, the ones that, you know, drink up all your beer, would come there, you know, I just didn't have that much. And anyway, I found two guys. I consider them, as I look at today, I've heard this, lower companions. When I drank with them, I felt much better about myself. One of them would fall right on his butt, and it's still 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And any other fella, I still got my tooth cracking cold Coors Light, because I don't like anything hot. I like it cold. And I drank like this for the last 8 or 9 years, but I always like to keep the hard liquor in the freezer. And it never burns. It never comes back up. And so I got accustomed to doing that wherever I was. My buddy, he'd always have some in the freezer. But anyway, I got up with these other two fellas. They lived 9 miles away. And they drank worse than I did. And so I'd hang out with them, and yeah, that got to be really boring. Same old thing. He's falling down. This guy's full of it, and it's no fun staying. You know, his wife wouldn't even let him in the house. He'd build a barrel fire in the three-sided shed, and you know, he'd tell me the same stories over and over again. And you know, I have to go around back and do something else just so I can feel, you know, good enough to hang out a little longer. And what I was doing, I was drinking that way for those 3 months so I could go home and just get rid of the whole day. And I did have some responsibilities when I moved here, but I was getting worse at it. There were two boys involved, young boys, and I was supposed to pick them up at the bus stop, and I'd be over at Raymond's house. And I became later and later and later, and I was causing trouble, and I was scaring the boys, and they're riding with me. By the way, I do have a daughter. Yeah, I need to get sober here in a little bit. I do have a daughter in one of those marriages, a beautiful daughter. She's 23, I believe. And I do remember one time she was with me. I really frightened her because I kind of slipped off the edge of the road, and it really scared me. And that was also some hard drinking when I had her, because I raised her for 8 years since she was 2 years old, for 8 years since she went back to Carolina with her mom. Don't know really exactly why, but that actually had some impact on my drinking. That, I think that's just the circumstances. You know, being raised from good folks, there were some things that were inherently still in me, but I really couldn't sustain that. But, you know, I was so anxious to see her go to my sister-in-law's for the weekend, and, you know, so I could really get good and drunk. So what I'd do is I'd pick her up after daycare, and I had, like, just enough time to drink two or three beers at the local spot right next door and take her home, do what I need to do, and finish it off with some good pot. When I came here in 1998, I'd been smoking pot since 1969. And when I stopped that day, I went to charter. There wasn't any problem with that. I'd done everything else there was under the sun, except I didn't like downers, and I never got into heroin. I had a little bit of sense about some of those things. I was interested in it when those guys at school were doing it. They looked like they were drunk. That's what they were doing. Thank God I didn't get into that. But anyway, I experimented with everything else, and I used some of that to help my drinking along. I did know if I smoked pot first, I could drink less. If I drank beer, if I drank anything first and then added something on top, boy, it's a double. And but anyway, I was in here. I'm back in Buckingham and with these guys, and you know, I tell you, I don't know. My story doesn't match everybody's story. You know, when I got into those meetings in the local area, and I wasn't hearing, you know, the things that I needed to hear, or maybe I couldn't hear it, or I really believe it just wasn't said. And you know, when I came to AA, I had a driver's license. I had a house. My parents hadn't disowned me. I'd never been shot. I'd never been stabbed. I've had some shotgun shells thrown at me, and you know, I've ducked a few times, and you know, I've stormed out too. I've thrown crock pots off of cliffs when I get mad. That's how I act when I get mad. I used to have this little red vein that stick up on the side of my head when my voice gets real loud, and whatever I say doesn't make any sense, but it sure gets you off my back, and it gives me a good reason to get away from you. And anyway, it wasn't anything really big going on. When I moved here, my friend at the time said, "Well, you've done enough for now. Can you take it easy?" And I had started to investigate about some work, and I was doing some work. And one day, she mentioned and said, "You know, I think you need some help." And it wasn't like I was just plastered the night before, or whether I'd done something extremely bad, or you know, whatever. It just wasn't that case. And you know, I think I paused for a second. I said, "Okay," and then I said, "You make the call." So I didn't know where I was going to end up. I didn't know I was going to end up in an AA meeting. I was forced to go to some back when I was a teenager, but I just don't know what that was about. You know, I lied on that questionnaire they give you, because I knew I don't want to let them know how much I drink. So maybe they'll give me fewer meetings. But anyway, and I said, "You make the call." And it was probably long in there. I was probably having some thoughts about you know, I wonder what it's going to be like not drinking. And I got these 3-gallon jars over here, and that's going to last me at least a year. That was some powerful stuff I'd grown. And you know, I held on to those 3 jars for 8 or 10 months. And I guess I got some information that I needed to hear. So I ended up getting rid of that. I haven't done anything. I haven't added anything to my body since January 18th, besides Tylenol and that kind of thing. That's it. That's all I, you know, that's it. Coffee, if you want to call that. But anyway, So I was going to these meetings, and I was still hearing about all the stuff that was going on, all the knifing and all the, all the horror stories, it just ain't me. And I did feel like I was in a safe place. I didn't rush away from the meeting every day. I don't know why, but so maybe there was something about AA. Maybe I was just there was enough grace there where I was around long enough to hear what I needed to hear. And so, like I said, I was down to one Saturday meeting and probably a Wednesday lunch or something like that, convenient meeting. And I did like those real small meetings, large meetings where I could hide in it, didn't have to say anything. And then the small one frightened me. I don't want to go there again. And sat in the back and that kind of thing. And anyway, so I was sitting in this meeting, and I still say he was sitting across the room, but he said he was sitting right beside me. But, the same old kind of meeting, but this one fella stuck out in there. He was talking about how he drank and some of the things would happen and some of the things he couldn't pull off when he was drinking and that sort of thing. And, I think when I was sitting in that meeting, I said to myself, I don't think there's any question about it. I think what happened was when that meeting was over, I ran up to him and told him, I said, I need some help. And that's what happened to me after not drinking for over 6 months. I need some help. As I've learned to do, ideally, he isolated me away from the other people that may have been trying to help or whatever. I can't say that was the case, but it avoids interference and mixed messages, that sort of thing. But anyway, I learned that later on. But we went outside and he asked me a series of simple questions. I'd say they're pretty much just reiterating the first three steps in very simple language. He didn't use any of the big scary words in there about God or anything of that stuff. He didn't do that. And I'd say it was pretty much the big book. I heard him talking about his drinking. That was identification right there. And then he mentioned the problem that I had, and then he mentioned there's a solution. And the problem I had was exactly what he said. From time to time, I can stop drinking. I can do that. Yep, the doctors. Yeah, but wait a minute, the doctors, that's 30 days. I was in the hospital for 4 days, fed intravenously, because it had a lot to do with my drinking. And that scared me. And after 30 days, I had that thing happen to me on the second time I was asked. I said, yeah, I have one. And that's what happens to me if I'm an alcoholic like Airtight here. I'm going to take a drink again if I don't do anything here. And I was convinced that day. I know I drank like this guy. And when I take a drink, or he was talking like this, when he takes a drink, he couldn't control the amount. And he didn't know where he was going to end up. And that sort of thing. And I went, yeah, that matches me. And he called that an allergy. And I said, all this flashed me. I've had that allergy since I was a teenager. Stuff comes in six packs and cases and that kind of thing. There's no two packs. And I just, on occasion, yes, maybe. But, the rule was no. You stock up. I never used liquor cabinets. I don't want to say those people that use liquor cabinets, but I hear some information in this meeting. I go up to him and ask for some help. He asked me these questions, and he said, "You just did the first three steps." And I said, "Okay." He said, "I believe you said when you want to feel better," and I said, "Right now." And so I guess he was testing me. He wanted to see if I was willing, I guess, and. So he went on to say some things that they really tested my willingness, and he said he found out where I lived, and he lived. I'm 45 miles from this meeting, and he's 10 minutes away from me, and so I, he said, "Can you come to my house on certain day. It was probably the following day, because this was on a Saturday. And I said, yeah. And he said, we're going to start an inventory. And I said, okay. And that's what I did. I needed a little bit of help with that, so he gave it to me. And the following weekend, I believe, it was within about 7, 8, 9 days. I remember the day I was in my kitchen by myself in this house all by myself. And I started this inventory and I had a little trouble getting going. You know, I had to use a big book. I used a little bit from these fellows from Arkansas. And I used really the same thing that's in the book, in the big book, but just sat on a piece of paper. And I was stupid, or I don't know if it's stupid, but it's good to be stupid, but I think. But anyway, once I got the knack of it, okay, once I started writing, you know, I kept going. And I didn't finish it all the way, but I think I probably did about half of it. I probably did the second column, or maybe just the first column on the first sitting. You know, I got all this stuff down on paper, like it says. And the next time I sat down, I finished it. And I don't believe there's any wrong way to do it, really, because I really didn't know how to do it, and I had enough instruction in front of me where I followed it. Furthermore, I had a sponsor, so when I went and shared that fourth step, he could elude some things in there that I quite couldn't understand, just couldn't quite see the pattern. But believe me, I saw a pattern when I got done. When I finished the last column, I don't know how to describe it, but I was at the kitchen table, and I stood up, and I said, you're a sick SOB. And I was laughing, and I had tears running in my eyes, just like that, and I went, wow. You know, actually, that was, you know, the first thing I'd really done, and, you know, I'd taken a look at it, and, you know, I felt a lot different, you know, for a period of time there, and so I went and did a fifth step with him, and I guess he see me choking up a little bit when I got started, and so he spilled something out on me, and then, you know, I'd kind of loosened it up, so I went on with my inventory, and you know, it was all the truth, you know, that's all it was all the truth. Anything I couldn't see, he'd help point it out, and probably a lot of things he saw, he didn't find necessary. I don't know. But what he did do, like I was talking in the beginning, he's put some structure in my life. I don't know, you call it a lot of different things discipline. Their book talks about discipline in one of the steps, and I need all the discipline I can get. I think there's a certain degree of willingness here, and I got that from what I understood that day, that I don't stand a chance, drinking or not drinking, unless I do this. I really knew that, so far I'm a one-timer here, and I know there's somewhere in our book it talks about permanent, and I like stuff like that. I like precision. I mean, I like precisely. I like that stuff. You know, I was an information gatherer. Still am. I like that information, but I did a little bit of that early in AA, and it won't work for me. I've tried working on stuff, and it doesn't work. And so what's happened is, you know, the word consistency came up, and what happened was, now I'm going to say one more thing, and then I'm going to finish up here, but there's this one fellow I was trying to help, and he was defiant, and I was trying to get him to maybe kind of conform a little bit, just see if he's willing, and he had a problem taking off, you know, kind of tidying up a little bit for the meeting. And you know, all this stuff I just watched and learned here, and he says, your sponsor make you wear a coat and tie to a meeting? I says, no, And I went and asked my sponsor a few days later, says, Al, have you ever made me do anything? He said, no, I can't. You know, what I thought about there is all I am is willing. You know, the reason I'm dressed like this today is because that's the way the first speaker I saw was dressed. And my sponsor, he wears a tie. So when he's at the podium and when I'm asked to be at the podium, I wear a tie. That guy thought I had somebody driving this down my throat. And that wasn't the case for me. You know, I've been willing up to this point. So I got a sponsor, but the way he made it real easy for me. He uh, he just immersed me in AA. You know, we rode to a lot of meetings. He plugged a tape in, so there's an hour I can't talk. You know, and then I could get to the meetings, an hour I can't talk. And then, you know, maybe on the way home, he turns that music up loud, which I did like that. And then I get out of the car, and then the next day I'll see you at 7 o'clock at such and such a place. And that's how I started out here. You know, I go to the same meetings, you know, every week. The weekends are open more for to move around a little bit, being that I'm slightly isolated where we live and I need to get out and, you know, find things. He put me to work, another one of these tricks, I thought at first. Immediately had me making coffee. And I was reluctant to give up that coffee job. But we do rotate here. There wasn't much rotation when the home group consisted of three or four people. So anyway, you know, you rotate from one job to the next. You never get a break. And so that home group now probably seats around 30-some now. You know, it's taken some years. What I like about it is everybody's, you know, on the same page there. We're all doing the same thing. That's what makes a home group. It is an AA group. That's where we carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and nothing else. I do go to one special meeting, I call it, during the week. I just can't believe this meeting. Is that an institution? I've been going there for over a year. And that's the most moving meeting I go to. These guys in here, they all understand, the ones that sit in there, all of them know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if they leave there and they don't do AA, they're coming back because they know they're alcoholic. Whether they're willing to get to the point where they do something there, it's up to them. But I've sat there and watched them in an institution take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and change right before your eyes. I mean, these guys, I mean, we have the guards in there saying, what are y'all doing in there? We don't take credit for that. That's AA. That kind of thing happens in there. But, you know, to see these guys' lives change in a prison, we know some have gotten out, and we know that if they're not in the meeting in a meeting right away, they're going to end up there. And because they sit in there and tell us that's what happens. So that's pretty clear in there what happens. But anyway, my life today, I can't really put a barometer on it. I have my lovely wife here tonight. You know, and I got to tell you that I don't know how. Put it this way, I'm glad both of us are in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this little red vein on the side of my head hadn't stuck out yet. As far as I know, which I don't mind somebody calling me on my stuff, I don't think I've raised my voice and gotten angry and thrown anything yet, and that sort of thing. I haven't stormed out. You know, even in conversation or anything, if we disagree with something, it seems like it's always agreeable. At least I don't go away pouting and quiet. It's just okay. That's amazing for a guy like me that I can't get along with anybody. You know, if I'm not getting along with anybody, I can't be helpful. I was thinking about this the other day. If I'm irritated, if I'm angry, which offends all alcoholics, and it'll kill me if I don't do something about it, is I can't be helpful. It's kind of been the latest topic here lately about resentment in that area of the book, because I think that's what this spiritual action does for us. It sets us up where enough self is reduced here where we can become helpful. So that's all I have to do is try to be helpful in AA. I'd thank Billy for asking me up here. He said he was all excited last week. I don't always get excited for this, but I do know why I'm here today. It's because of Alcoholics Anonymous and taking the action here. I can take the knowledge here and get drunk and get sick. A lot of reporters come in here and telling me that. The key for me is willingness and to let a sponsor impose his judgment over me and others. That's why I go to the consistently go to the same meetings because everybody gets to know me, especially my home group. And there's a lot of interaction before and outside the meeting where I don't have to take up my sponsor's valuable time. Now, any time is valuable to him if you're willing. I'll show you that. If you're not willing, it's a waste of time. And obviously, I feel the same way. I've tried to help some guys here, but not willing, have to move on. Best thing me to do is go find a place where I can find somebody willing. And sometimes I don't always do that. So today, I need to get out of here. I need to move around and go to Richmond more, et cetera. But anyway, I think I'm running out of time here, and so that means I'm done. Thank you.